Louis XIV's often savage persecution of his Huguenot subjects let loose a flood of Protestant refugees, many of whom sought refuge in England. And these people came to England bringing with them, in a sense, proof of Protestant allegations of Catholic cruelty and of Catholic intolerance, because that's what they themselves had experienced. Indeed, in the year 1678, there was a truly bizarre incident, which is usually referred to by historians as the Popish Plot, which drove anxieties even higher. It should be stressed at the outset that the Popish Plot never existed. It was dreamed up by two eccentrics, I think is perhaps the most charitable thing we can call them, Titus Oates, who was a failed clergyman, and Israel Tongue, who was another clergyman who hadn't failed but was nonetheless very poor. And these two, Oates and Tongue, imagined for themselves a kind of vast conspiracy to murder the king, naturally driven by Catholics. It was to be followed by the usual suspects, that is to say, uprisings by the Catholics in Ireland and an invasion from Catholic France. And shortly, as soon as this plot had been announced in 1678, again, a kind of panic gripped the country, like the panic of 1640 to 1642. The militia was called out, Catholic homes were searched, and by 1681, at least 35 people had been tried and executed for their part in a plot which, at least insofar as modern historians can establish, had never really existed. Moreover, it spread beyond persecuting the domestic minority. Attacks were also made on Charles's ministers, and in May of 1679, the English Parliament passed a so-called exclusion bill, which provided that James, Charles's brother, should be excluded from the royal succession on Charles's death. How did Charles II respond? He simply dissolved Parliament. For the next 2 years, that is to say between 1679 and 1681, the political nation in England would be divided over this question of exclusion. Should the king's brother James be barred from the throne or not? And I think we can divide the political nation into, roughly speaking, two groups. First of all, the Whigs, who were in favor of exclusion. They wanted to bar James. They were sympathetic to Protestant dissenters, and they were also critical of the established Anglican Church. The other group we'll call, they were called Tories. They were anti-exclusionists. They laid an awful lot of stress on the legitimacy of the monarchy, its genealogical legitimacy, and they wanted to protect the Anglican Church against dissenters. What is interesting about this exclusion crisis between 1679 and 1681, which bears all kinds of resemblances to the crises that Charles I had gone through in the early 1640s, is that in 1679, the crown was really an awful lot stronger and the opposition an awful lot weaker than had been the case in 1641. The biggest weakness faced by the Whigs, those who wanted to bar James from the throne, is in many respects reminiscent of the weakness faced by those Catholic radicals who didn't want Henry of Navarre, the Protestant Henry of Navarre, to become king of Catholic France in the late 16th century. And that is, who else is going to become king? What was the alternative to James? The choices were either, number one, a bastard, as they would have been called in the early modern period, not too good to have that on the throne, or second of all, James's daughter Mary, who was a Protestant, but she was married to a foreign head of state, William of Orange in the Netherlands, and it was feared that William would drag England into a series of expensive wars against France. And I should note parenthetically that these fears would ultimately prove correct. Moreover, it's not just that the crown's opponents were weak, but the crown itself was very strong. There were multiple sources of the crown's strength. First of these was Charles II himself. He was an astute politician, and he remained flexible. He insisted on his brother's rights, but he did have a knack for making minor concessions at the right points to ease the criticisms and ease the tension. He would bring Whigs onto the Privy Council, and so he managed the crisis fairly well from a political point of view. Second of all, Charles II had determined support of the various social and political elites of the country. Since 1660, indeed, Charles II had packed the various courts in England with lawyers of authoritarian leanings, like the notorious Lord Chief Justice Kelling, who in 1667 referred to the hallowed agreement Magna Carta as Magna Farta. Third of all, Charles II had an awful lot of financial strength. He received subsidies from the French crown, from Louis XIV, but in particular, Charles II had the advantage of having been granted certain kinds of taxes, customs taxes and excise taxes, which had been granted to him for life by Parliament, which made him, relatively speaking, independent of Parliament for financial reasons. He didn't need Parliament for money, since he had it from other sources as well. It's worth noting that these taxes, these customs taxes and excise taxes, were socially regressive, that is to say, they were disproportionately paid by the poor and the common people. They kept the burden off social elites, that made them popular among the political nation. Moreover, On a more positive note, the expansion of English commerce during the later 17th century meant that customs revenues went up a great deal. And indeed, Charles's ordinary revenue, that is to say, the revenue he regularly collected, went up something like 60% between 1660 and 1685. Again, a marked contrast with the financial crises plaguing the Stuart crown in the early 17th century.